Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 96 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. How are you all doing, man? Thank you all for tuning in. It's been a hectic few weeks, isn't it? I had to do a bonus podcast, not this Sunday, just gone, the Sunday before that. And man, it's been hectic, and you guys have been amazing, basically. Thank you very much for your reaction to my first bit of new music in a few years now, but I've been busy. No whimpers, that's on YouTube now, if you want to check that out, youtube.com/ScroobiusPip, go check it. But the reaction to that was absolutely amazing. You guys are awesome. And it was fun to do. I explained this in the bonus podcast, but it's basically, I did a similar track a few years back called No Nimbus, where I heard a song, I had an idea for a lyric to go over that song. I wrote the lyric, recorded the lyric, had it kind of produced and mixed and mastered, had a video idea, organized the video, shot the video, edited the video and put the video up, all in 7 days. So I first started writing the lyrics 7 days before you lot all got to see it, and it kind of it caused some problems. It didn't cause problems, but people like Amy, who runs the speech development, a record social media, I forgot to mention it to her because it happened so quick. Sage Francis and B Dolan, you know, all some of my closest friends and work partners, I forgot to mention it to any of them. So everyone kind of woke up going, all right, there's new music from Pip. That was completely unexpected, and no one warned us. Sorry guys, but that was kind of the nature of it. On to this week's podcast. I've got Kathy Burke, which is fantastic news. I should mention, I mentioned the label in that there, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's our label. So go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com to get Distraction Pieces podcast merch. You can support, you can become part of Team 3W by getting one of the Team 3W t-shirts or mugs. And there's also tons of good stuff on there. There's beautiful, there's DVDs, there's t-shirts, there's barbecue aprons, god damn it. And soon there will be the new speech development cap, which is featured in the No Whimpers video. I've got a lot of love and hype on that, so that's good. That's on its way, it's almost ready. Yeah, let's get into this podcast. Is there anything else I wanted to mention? I'm sure there was something else I felt I had to say then. Oh yeah, there's a brand new Tuesday Night Jaw out. So Tuesday Night Jaw is our wrestling podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network, hosted by Jim Smallman. And a new one dropped last night, on Tuesday night, ironically, as you can guess from the name. So go and check that out. I'd recommend you quickly click to start that downloaded now, so by the time you finish this, you've got that. Again, the support for that has been amazing. Considering Jim is new to that kind of... He's been doing his own podcast on and off for a while, but he's new to our network at the very least, and the podcast is brand new. Considering the first episode put us straight at number two, it was the number two podcast in the iTunes sports podcast chart, so it's mental, and you guys are amazing. So yeah, check that out. Kathy Burke, another thing I think you should check out, I mentioned this in the podcast, but she was on Adam Buxton's podcast recently, and it was absolutely fantastic. And the reason I say you should 100% check it out is because we tried not to go over the same stuff here. So there's some really interesting stories on there of her relationship with Gary Oldman throughout her career, the love, hate, annoyance type relationships, and there's some hilarious stories and some beautiful moments there. So check that out. But yeah, I mean, this was an amazing chat. It's the first time we've met. We'd chatted on Twitter for a bit and got on and enjoyed each other. So it was a great one to set up, and I got to go and visit Kathy at home, and she was the most welcoming and open and friendly person. And genuine, again, I don't end up saying this at the time, but it's people like Kathy, Ed Skrein on the other week, and a few others that I'm learning so much from as a new actor, as a new person in the acting world. I'm learning so much from, even in these brief conversations. So yeah, absolute honor and pleasure to chat to Kathy. I'm going to let the podcast play out now. At the end, I'm going to tell you some really exciting stuff about upcoming guests, and there's one in particular that I really want to tell you a bit about. So I'll do that at the end because it's exciting and I don't want to distract from this. So this is episode 96 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Kathy Burke. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. It's all natural and just
and you're
just
right, the dishwasher going?
Yeah, it's fine.
I put that on me just...
Especially.
Well, I completely... Oh, I'm in my own world, really.
That's good. You've allowed me
into
your home.
You set up all this sound
home,
equipment,
so...
and then I put the dishwasher on.
No, it's perfect. It gives a nice tone and atmosphere,
yes.
Doesn't it? It's sound design for the podcast.
Yes, although someone, when I did Adams, someone tweeted... Right, so you were talking about the acoustics. You were either in the conservatory or the kitchen. I'm assuming so that you could smoke.
Perfect.
I was like, yes, to both. You know, you're absolutely right.
That's great. Well, I mean, I'll introduce now. I'm joined by Kathy Burke today, and you mentioned you did Adams, and that was great. Did you enjoy your experience? Was that your first podcast?
That was my very first podcast with Adam Buxton.
Yep.
And I did actually. Because I've met him a couple of times,
yeah,
and it was just nice to have a sort of free and easy chat.
It's a nice format, man, just that openness and just not having that pressure of it being a promo thing or anything else. It's just a genuine conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but I think your exact words when I got here was that his setup was shit compared to mine. But I don't know if that's the exact words, but, you know, still, I'm sure it was nice.
Well, his is a little bit more like, he was more like the teenage version of...
I've got too much kit.
Your kit is extraordinary.
Particularly in this weather, just lugging it about in the heat. It's not wise. But, I mean, it's good that we started off mentioning Adam's podcast, because obviously we don't want to go over too much of the same stuff. I'm sure some things... I will, but
yeah.
I do want to recommend that people go and listen to that, because his podcast's great anyway. So, we kind of arranged this over Twitter, and that was all nice. We've been going back and forth a bit on it. Is Twitter the first kind of social media that's lured you in?
Yeah.
And what lured you in? What was the appeal?
Well, I don't know, really. I don't know what it was. I've been so sort of against it.
Yeah.
I was against it for reasons that were quite valid, really, in that my friends that were into it suddenly stopped ringing or texting.
Right, yeah.
And I was getting really angry.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I've got a lot of pals that are on it, and I understand it now that when you're first on it, it can be quite addictive.
Yeah, it really can.
But I sort of was getting the ump because I'd text a mate and say... Am I seeing you this weekend? What's going on? And then I wouldn't hear from them.
Yeah.
And then you'd hear that they're responding to people they don't fucking know on Twitter. And I was like, hang on a minute, you've got my number. Why aren't you ringing or texting me?
It's a scary world to have too much information. Like, someone's not responded, but you can check that they have done this or
have
done
they
that.
Didn't. I was spying on them all the time. I was always looking it up and going, oh, I know they're up.
Yeah.
Because they're on fucking Twitter.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I was always a bit pissed off, but it was really for that reason and that reason alone. And, I sort of thought it was great, just from an outsider's point of view, just for, like, the world, really.
Yeah.
People that suddenly didn't have a voice could suddenly have a voice.
Completely, and particularly from, like, a media and news point of view, so much news can come through uncontrolled and unfiltered. And
absolutely.
It can be worrying because it can be inaccurate, because people are reporting stuff and retweeting stuff, but still, that pure public and free voice is... exciting.
Yeah, very much so. And I was never interested in Facebook.
Yeah.
Because
Facebook is the worst for losing friends to, like, in that they'll start a group or something or an event.
Oh,
and
okay.
You'll just, if you're not on Facebook, it's like as if you don't exist. It's like, how did you not
there
know?
There was a big time period of time where I just wasn't being invited to parties and stuff. And
because they've posted about it. They've posted, you must know.
Yeah, and it's like, well, I don't know, you know. And so that was always a little bit frustrating.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was one of my best friends is a great woman called Frances Barber.
Right.
And Frankie started Twitter about, I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago now, maybe. And it sort of worried me a few times because she was, you know, she was getting a lot of abuse, actually. And
that's the bits you notice as well. You notice the abuse rather than the pleasantries.
Exactly. And I was sort of frightened for her a lot of the time.
Right.
But anyway, and she sort of reassured me and said, oh, no, there are enough people on there that are good people.
Yeah.
That have got my back, you know, and they're looking out for me and all this business. Anyway, to cut a long story short, Frank was here one night last year. And I was really, really low. I'd been very depressed. And, you know, even funny people like myself are prone to depression. You know, we're not all jolly all the time.
100%.
And most of the time I've got the ump, you know. Yeah. And most of the time I'm depressed, you know. And last year I was in a particularly bad way. And anyway, and Frank came round. An old friend of mine, Kitty Finer, had released a new video.
Yeah.
And her mum, Marcia, texted me and said, this is Kit's new video and all the rest of it. Not asking me to do anything, just sharing it. So, and I had never, ever asked any of my friends to tweet anything. Because I was so anti it, I thought, well, I can't be a hypocrite, and I can't ask them there, but would you mind?
It's terrible, but why are you there?
Yeah. And so anyway, so I said to Frank, oh, would you tweet Kit's video for me? And Frankie just said, well, why don't you do it?
Great response.
She said, just go on it and do it, you know. So I thought, I'll sod it. All right, then. And anyway, I woke up the next day and I had 600 notifications and I didn't know what was going on and I didn't know how to switch it off.
You have to learn to turn all that stuff off quite quick.
Oh, my God. I was like, Jesus, what's happened? And so anyway, my next response when somebody said, oh, my God, I can't believe you're on Twitter. So I just put up, oh, shit, I thought it was Tinder. And, you know, so then, and people don't know it's really you to start with.
Yeah.
Because I know there'd been a couple of people pretending to be me.
Right.
Like in the early days, you know.
And is there that weird thing of not wanting to go out over the top in proving it's you, but still kind of annoying? It fucking is me. Ugh. It's like, I don't think it's you. It's, well, I don't care, but I kind of do care if you don't.
Yeah.
It really is.
But anyway, I was just sort of, I was lucky because. Because when you're a sort of well-known person, I don't know. I just think things like this are sort of easier somehow, you know.
Yeah.
Because you get people. Yeah. Listen, I had people being horrible to me and whatever. I'm old enough, thank God, and ugly enough not to fucking give a shit you know, I've been called all sorts from Dot and some twat. You know, in the back arse of somewhere on his computer.
Whose picture's an egg.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Telling me on this, that and the other ain't going to have no effect on me whatsoever. Yeah. So that was, all that side of it was fine. And I learnt quite quickly, you just ignore it, you know. Yeah. And, but it was sort of working out, but who do I follow? It was really more that. It was like, well, where are my kindred spirits? Yeah. I don't know who the like-minded are. And I'm not just going to follow famous people.
Yeah.
Because I think half of them are wankers. I'm not really. And they think I'm a wanker. So it's like, well, why would I do that, you know? But then slowly but surely, obviously, you suss it out.
Get to know it and get to understand the landscape.
Once I understood the thing about retweeting.
Yeah.
And once I understood, really, don't grab it and quote it. And go, oh, I like this.
Yeah.
And then, because then I thought, oh, no, then you get all the tweet. They don't retweet the thing you're saying, I like this.
Yeah.
So then I learnt, just retweet. And then once I realised, oh, I don't know who this person is, this Ken Shabby, but I keep on retweeting him, so I better follow him.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I better sort of.
It's nicely organic in that way, is even the people you follow will keep retweeting someone and you'll start to be, all right, well,
exactly.
I should give them a follow and take that in.
So it's taken me a while, but I'm slowly sort of just, you know, it's like when you like, it's like you glean someone's personality and, you know, you don't know who the hell they are a lot of the time, you know. But there's a guy, you must know Andy Dawson, who does Get in the Sea.
Yes, 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 yes.
So
it's a brilliant profile. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. And Andy's just, he's just started doing a podcast with Bob Mortimer.
Oh, amazing.
Called Atletico Mints, I think it's called. Anyway, but Andy, he's just brilliant. And
yeah.
He's like a bulldog from Sunderland. And
yeah.
I just love his morals. And what I noticed about him is that, because it's mainly women that get abuse on Twitter and
yeah,
things,
yeah.
You know, it's always people
and brutally as well, like it gets dark and
really dark,
horrific,
really horrible, but
and until you stumble upon it as a male, you don't kind of comprehend or take
exactly.
in how brutal and harsh it can
yeah.
be.
And then people like Andy and this other guy Nick Pettig, I can never say his name. Nick. Oh, anyway, Nick. He knows
Nick
who he
something.
Is. But but they would come in and defend, you know,
yeah.
or they would tell people to fuck off, you know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
And that was wonderful, really. And I sort of felt like I didn't even know this bloke Andy, and yet within 6 weeks, I felt like, oh, there's my Twitter brother.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
how I felt about him. It's like, oh my goodness. This is like having your brother on Twitter, you know, that's just there and being brilliant and really funny and really outrageous, but has got a great moral compass.
Yeah,
and
it can genuinely be a great, and it's not always, as all of these things, they're not always used in that way, but they can be great for meeting people and meeting kindred spirits and kindred
yeah.
thinkers that you wouldn't have been able to meet otherwise, that are distant and are. And you can question that there's a worrying element that it may stop you seeking engagement or interaction in real life because you've got this kind of online world. But I think if it's balanced right, it's a beautiful
babe,
thing.
I'm 51. I don't fucking
yeah.
go out anyway.
Exactly.
I've been out for 10 years.
It's a good, it works
know?
Perfectly then, doesn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, you know. And actually, within the year, a lot of these people, are like, I do consider them now friends,
yeah.
you know, and we have all met up. And
yeah.
we have all been out for a drink.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah, that's great.
You know, there was a big gang of us. Andy had his book launch for the Get in the Sea book.
Yeah.
And a gang of us met up. I haven't been in a pub intentionally. Right, you know, I go to a pub if I'm on my way to the theatre
yeah,
somewhere.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But I haven't actually had a night in a pub for like 10 years.
Yeah.
Because I don't go into pubs
yeah.
anymore. And, you know, it was just sort of fantastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, and another friend of mine said to me recently, they said, but it's so strange because you've become friends with these people so quickly. But I said, but it's no different to doing an acting gig. Because when
yeah,
you do
well,
an
you're
acting
thrown
gig,
in.
Absolutely. You could work with people for 4 weeks and they're your friends for life.
Yeah.
Or you never see them again,
yeah.
you know. But you get, you're just used to getting close to people.
Yeah.
Very, very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in this business.
Yeah.
You know? And you learn how to get along with people very, very quickly.
Completely.
You know?
And I mean not to it feels like this is now just a big advert for Twitter and social media, but not to overhype the impact, but when you are someone that's susceptible to things like a depression, now I have a lot of insomnia, and social media can be a godsend in those situations, because just being able to post a picture on Instagram and have a quick chat with someone you
yeah.
don't know, just have someone, some kind of interaction,
yeah.
it can really take the pressure off and take you outside of your own head
exactly.
a little bit, which is
yeah.
a huge benefit.
I absolutely think, without a doubt, it has helped me this past year.
Yeah.
It really has, because it infuriates me a lot, you know,
yeah.
but it... Without fail, it has made me cry with laughter every day.
Yeah, yeah.
There are so many funny people out there.
Yeah.
They are so sharp,
yeah.
you know, and so quick. I mean, I can't think that quickly. They're so on it.
Instant
as soon
on things
as
that
the subject comes
yeah.
out. It's like, bloody hell, these people, they're just so smart,
yeah.
you know.
It's kind of nice as well, I think, and... particularly, I mean, I was excited when you appeared on Twitter suddenly, because you are someone that kind of, and we'll get on to a theatre we definitely have to talk about, because
oh,
you promised
do.
Your
yeah,
followers
yeah,
we will.
Yeah.
But because you kind of stepped away from acting and the screen a lot and went
yeah.
into theatre, it was nice. I think social media is a great way to be able to let people know the real you a bit more. And when I joined, I was adamant on that, because a lot of my early songs in particular were quite, came across as quite highbrow and intelligent. And there's elements of that, but I'm not as clever as they all thought. Mm. So it's kind of nice to kind of be able
likewise
to go, look, this is the real me.
Kind
of, if people are going to hate me, I'd rather they know me and hate me. Do you know what I mean? They hate the real me than this fictional version of me that they've created.
That is so true.
It's like, you're fine to hate me. That's fine. That's humans. We don't all get on. We're not
all
going to click.
And we're all multi-layered, man.
Yeah.
You know, I get people, like, some people, you know, because I've been pissed on there a couple of times, which I really like, actually. Yes. I love being pissed. It's usually when Question Time's on, because I don't watch Question Time anymore. So I like that they're all ranting and raging
about... Twitter comes alive during Question
Time,
doesn't it?
So I just call everyone a... I said I wouldn't swear on this one.
Everyone knows, encouraged.
Everyone knows what I call people.
Yeah.
And I just like getting involved in the argy-bargy. But because I've done that a couple of times, people assume that I'm pissed every night.
Right.
Now, they look back on if they can be arsed.
Yeah.
Really, I probably get pissed, like, once every 3 weeks, you know? And, but people think, oh, are you drunk again? The amount of tweets I've had, oh, you had a drink again, if I'm expressing something.
Yeah.
And one bloke got on me, whoever it was, it's usually a bloke. Sorry, men, you are beautiful, but sometimes you can fuck right
absolute
off.
Absolute nightmares.
And I was tweeting something, I was sort of pissed off about something, and this bloke just went, oh, are you pissed again? Are you on the juice again? And I just went, fuck off, I'm stoned, twat.
Yeah.
If anyone who really knows me knows, I don't really actually drink that much.
Yeah.
I'm not a juicehead, as someone called me the other day. Brilliant. I had to Google it, because I didn't know I didn't know what that meant. I thought, oh, do they know I'm a vegetarian? And that's why. And actually it was like, no, calling me a pisshead. But it's like, well, no, I'm not a pisshead, I'm a stoner.
I love that you have to check to see if it's an insult or a compliment.
Of course,
hang on, was this, am I happy with you or angry with you?
I have to Google.
Give me
so
a minute.
Much. Because I really don't know what half of the vernacular is. Like all the LMAO. And
yeah, there's loads.
I didn't know what any of that meant, you know? So I would Google
you'll
it
start,
or I'd just text my friend Anthony Cotton.
Very soon you'll start to use it ironically and then it'll just become part of your lexicon and it'll be killer because you will lol at things. I never thought I'd lol, but now I keep lolling. It's painful.
Well, I was doing that right at the start, all the lols and, you know, whatever, because I just thought, oh, that's what you do, isn't it?
That's how they communicate. That's how these people communicate.
I didn't even know what I was saying, you know.
That's beautiful. So the last part on social media, it must be nice to come into it and kind of see, again, like we've spoken about swearing. And for me, swearing is an important part of language. It can be a beautiful part of language. It can be a beautiful part of expression. Yeah, Lenny Bruce and all sorts of other people have illustrated amazingly how powerful it can be and if we demonise it. But the beauty of things like Twitter is that it is uncensored and people can get offended, but they're allowed to be offended just as much as you're allowed to cause offence if you so choose.
Absolutely. And people can unfollow you,
you
know? Like, people knew right away, it's like, look, I'm not here to be polite.
Yeah.
I'm not here to keep my mouth shut. I've been told to keep my mouth shut since I could speak. I ain't keeping my fucking mouth shut for no one. If you don't like what I'm saying, you could just unfollow me or block me or, you know.
The most polite I am on there is when I'm explaining that you can unfollow. Because that is a genuine thing. It's like, I don't want to be a dick, but that's so true. It's subscription. If you are walking past my house and you hear me swearing in conversation, you can't really knock on the door and go, can you not swear, please?
Yes.
Oh, it's like, you're walking past my fucking house.
And
so
one would assume
didn't need to listen.
that kids aren't on it, you know. And if kids are on it, that are under 16 or whatever, then that's their parents' fault that they're on it, or their whoever their guardians are.
And they're gonna, there's worse things they're going to find on the internet than someone having a rant and a swear, guarantee
it. Oh, God, yeah. Horrendous things, you know. But
so let's talk, as you tweeted, promising you'd talk about a theatre, which, again, it's an interesting one because you're so known for a lot of your acting performances in drama and in comedy, and we'll get on to some of that.
But from 20 years ago
That's what I was going to say, from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's that weird thing of when you disappear from the screen, you disappear from a certain range of people's yes. knowledge and existence. But the fact is, your last 10, 20 years have been some of your most successful, and I'd imagine most rewarding years
yes.
in theatre. So what was the draw to theatre? Like, initially, like, were you into it when you were younger? Or
yeah, no, not too young. You know, sort of this was all... I went to the Anna Share Theatre Workshop yep. place, and...
Which is when... And Neil Maskell went as well and spoke of when we did the podcast
That's
together.
That's right. Yeah. But he's younger than me, yeah, Neil, yeah. you see. So I didn't know Neil
I mean,
then.
He said at the time, like, one of the things... He knew that Kathy Burke went there and things like that. And, right. you know, there was this... It had some people who it had that kind of
yeah.
respect and
well,
aura
I went
over.
There because Phil Daniels went yeah. there and yeah. Pauline Quirk went there.
Yeah.
You know, when I was... I think Pauline Quirk's actually very underrated, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, she's not a mate of mine. I'm not using this yeah. to big her up, you know what I mean? You know, when I was a young girl watching television... Pauline was in brilliant things. She was yeah. in Play for Today's, and she had her own kids programme, you know,
yeah.
Pauline's Quirks. And,
yeah.
you know, it was just sort of fantastic. And
the variation.
Yeah. yeah. I you know, she was a real hero of mine when I was young, along with people like Glenda Jackson and
yeah.
Irene Handel,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
you know, all these fantastic women. And, you know, and Pauline Quirk was in there.
And there was a point that she was as big as you can get, like when with the Birds of a Feather type phase, and that
yeah.
was people.
But she
I
went
know,
through some
quite
what's the word? You know, there wasn't much happening before Birds of a Feather.
Yeah.
You know, I think there was a thing where you know she was very used a lot when she was young.
Yeah,
and then she did. It used to be a great program on called Angels,
mm-hmm.
Which was about nurses. And then it just seemed to all go quiet for her, you know. I mean, the bollock of this business is you go in and out of fashion, you know.
Yeah, and it, I mean, particularly for... And I think you kind of touched upon it with Adam, I think, but particularly for women in acting, there's a point where all the roles become the same, essentially.
Yeah.
You get to this certain point where it's like, right, there's only one kind of role that you can play. And it's weird, because when you get... that bit older, it kind of opens up again a bit, because
yes.
there's more variation or depth in character at
well,
least, but there's
right.
that middle point where it's just, here's all you can be.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I've done a couple of acting jobs in recent years,
yeah.
and it's really because I like being older. I like now being 50,
yeah.
and I like, you know, I've played, a couple of characters, you know, that are sort of... old, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And interesting,
yeah.
Three-dimensional, because now they've got age as another layer, you see.
Yeah, there's more
and
in it
so
than just being the love interest or
exactly.
these other just typical easy roles.
And I hated being the love interest.
Yeah.
I couldn't handle it. I
yeah.
just didn't like it at all. But I think I talked about that one. See, I didn't listen to the one Adam did.
And
he
edits them
in.
And keeps them in and out. Yeah.
yeah.
But yeah.
But, no, I mean, it's strange because, you know, I went on the Tube last year for the first time in 20 years.
Yeah, oh, wow.
And I realised I stopped going on the Tube because of getting recognised.
Yeah.
you know, especially in the height of things with the Harry Enfield show. And
well, that was the thing. The Harry Enfield show, really, looking back, since then, obviously, things like the Fast Show and Little Britain, but the Harry Enfield show was one of the first that really had strong catchphrases. So
yes.
that's the worst for getting recognised, I'd imagine, because you'll have certain things that people will,
oh,
in a loving and endearing way, but
yes.
will repeat over to you again and
absolutely.
Again.
Absolutely. And it could do your nut in.
Yeah.
You know, it did my nut in. The boys handled it a lot better than me,
yeah.
Harry and Paul, you know.
Yeah.
But it used to drive me crazy. And I think... See, with me, I'm such a snooty bitch, really, because also another actress that I greatly admired when I was growing up was Alison Steadman.
Right.
And the thing I found so genius about Alison Steadman was that you didn't know what she looked like.
Right.
You know, she played Beverly, and then she was in Nuts in May, and it was like, but hang on a minute, this can't be
the same
woman,
yeah.
you know? And I think, because back then, this is in the late 70s, you know, there wasn't all the interviews that go on. And I think actors could be more anonymous.
But it's such a rare privilege to get to be that as well. Because, again, in general, I think
people these days strive to be that recognisable actor, because I guess it could be seen as you're more marketable or you're more this, that, but to be able to be, I want to be that character.
Yes.
That's amazing. That's admirable.
Yeah. And so I always sort of thought this thing of, see, with me, I didn't want to be famous.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want that really.
Yeah.
I found it a bit sort of, it sort of got in the way. It just got in the way, you know, and this might be to do with my own ego or whatever, but it was just that thing of, oh, flip, now, you know, like when I got the award at Cannes for Kneel by Mouth, that was such a sort of double-edged sword, really, because, you know, on the one hand, it was wonderful, and I genuinely, hand on heart, was more pleased for the film than I was for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because for me, it sort of was the beginning of things fucking up a bit for me.
Right.
You know? Because suddenly, like you say, you're a commodity, you know?
Yeah, you're not just being cast as this character, you're being cast as Kathy Burke, Cannes Award winner.
Exactly.
So on and so forth.
And it just didn't sit easy with me.
Right.
You know? And it was, I mean, it was literally within a couple of years that I stopped. I think the last sort of proper acting job I did was a film with Shane Meadows, actually. And
Once Upon a Time in the Midlands,
yes,
was it that one? Yeah.
Yeah.
And, great stuff. I love Shane as well.
Well, I never saw it. That was a bit of a bummer, actually, because when I met Shane, because I was a massive fan, like everyone was at that time, and even more so now, with the brilliance of This Is England.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I met Shane, and it was Paddy Considine was meant to be in the movie, and that was it. And then all these sort of new Nottingham people and all the rest of it. And I just thought, great, I'll just go in and do a bit with this guy because I think he's brilliant. But then everything changed. I think Paddy got a big American film, like his first big break.
Right.
It was a film with Jim Sheridan.
Yeah.
And so Paddy was no longer on Midlands. And so Rhys Iffins came onto it. And I adore Rhys.
Mm-hmm.
I adore Rhys literally more than anybody in the world.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, not again. Because we'd already worked together.
Right, right.
And I just thought, oh, crumbs. And then Ricky Tomlinson, who I'm also a big fan of, but I suddenly like. Anyway, and I.
This isn't what I thought it was going to be.
Well, and I said to Shane, I had another meeting with Shane. I said, look, I'm really worried. I said, because suddenly we're all sort of well known.
Right.
And this isn't the way.
Because that
you
was the
work.
Excitement of Paddy at the time, where
of
he'd
course.
Come from out of nowhere and done these amazing performances.
I mean,
and
my,
then yeah,
my God, and then since then, like Vicky McClure and and like you say, beautiful Stephen Graham, you know, and it was, you know, and I was just a bit, oh, but I think Shane, you know, he like he said to me, look, you're all people I want to work with, so why can I not work with you?
You know,
does that make sense?
Yeah, I get that.
But I think it was a money... I think the producers were a bit on his back, you know?
Yeah, to put some names...
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, I've never seen it, but I know that it was sort of his least successful film. And I think there's a real lesson.
It's good, though.
There.
I really enjoyed it.
Did
just
you?
So you know. Just,
oh, well,
just,
well that's
just
nice enough.
Out of interest. It's still very good. But yeah, it is interesting because I guess it's that typical thing in this industry where Shane's skill and the love that Shane got coming up was picking people who you hadn't seen and getting this gold out of them. And then, bizarrely, the industry will tend to go, that's amazing, right, now do something with people we do all know. And all
that. Well,
that's not what I do. That's not what I do best. But it's that, it seems afterwards they kind of allowed him to do the same again, as you said, with This Is England and things like that,
where
he seemed to pluck people out.
I could have always said no, I suppose, looking back, but... I wanted to work with him.
You know? Yeah.
And so did Ricky and so did Rhys, you know what I mean? But I just sort of felt, oh, this doesn't and Robert Carlyle was in it, of course. He was the big
name.
Of course. Can't forget him, you know. Oh, but it was
And that
just,
was when he was proper at his peak as well.
Oh,
my really
goodness. Yeah, yeah,
names.
He was fantastic. Yeah. And that was great because I'd never worked with Robert. So that was sort of lovely, you know, but it was... And Shirley Henderson, you know, but it was just a bit... anyway, I sort of thought then... Because going back, anyway, I'd always loved theatre and yeah. I'd always sort of been really interested in directing theatre, more than acting in theatre. And, you know, and I did a play, a Jonathan Harvey play, and then there was another play came along and I couldn't do this other play, whatever it was, because I had commitments as an actor.
Yeah.
And I just thought, all these acting commitments I've now got, which seem to be non-stop, you know, like I've got 2 years' worth of work lined up, which is great, and that's
lovely
way,
to be in demand.
Oh,
it's lovely
God.
To...
And this is how you should feel as an actor, like, at last, do you know what I mean? I'm getting the work and all the rest of it, but I wasn't happy, you know? Yeah. And it sounds so selfish, but I just wasn't happy.
It's a really... A weird one to try and deal with when you're in a situation that you know so many people would kill to be in.
Exactly.
But it's not satisfying you. It's not what you wanted it to be, or it's not how you wanted it to be. And that's a tough thing to come to terms with. And because there's not only that you're not happy with it, there's also the guilt of not being happy with it.
Exactly.
Really, you should be over the moon because you've won this award and you're doing these films, but you're kind of...
I did feel really guilty, actually. Yeah. But anyway, I had a meet up with my agent, Stephen, and I just said, look, I just don't want to accept any acting work for the next year, 2 years, because I want to focus on theatre directing. Yeah. And the acting work is now getting in the way, you know, of me directing theatre. Yeah. And I thought it would be a couple of years, and I thought that I would get I'd itch to be acting again, you know. But it never happened, and
it's very telling, isn't it? When you know, you said you think I need a break from it to come back, but then if you find the rewarding nature that you weren't finding, if you find that in something else, then that's a tough one to go, right, I'll go back to acting now. It's like, well, if you're finding all that from directing, from theatre directing, then...
Yeah, I just get a real kick out of it. It's so hard to explain. It's hard to talk about anything, I think, to do with acting or directing... Or any, you know, without... It just sounds so wanky and it sounds so indulgent, you know. But I don't care. I love this business.
Yeah.
You know, I love being a part of it, you know. And I just like the old-fashioned storytelling, you know. And it's a great way for people to empathise with other human beings, and I'm all for that, you know. And I just love it. And people have often said to me, oh, you like the control. It must be the control you like. And I used to find that a bit insulting, you know, and because it is a sort of negative thing. Oh, you just want to control everything.
But actually,
I fucking do, you know, because I want to choose the people that are in the room that I'm going to have to work with. Because I've had to work with some right tossers and some right arseholes and bullies and twats. And hopefully, with me being in charge...
Yeah.
The only arsehole and twat in the room is me.
Yeah, and,
you know?
and the fact is, you're not in charge by accident. You've put work in to get to the point to be the person in charge. So, again, that shouldn't be anything that you should be ashamed of, that you like that control.
No,
equally, I think that area, or the appeal of that kind of control, can also be because it's all on your shoulders then. If it fails, you can't blame it on someone else. You can't say, like, well... They change the actors at the last minute and things like that. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of right. No, if it fails, it's your own fault. But also, if it succeeds, you get that real sense of achievement of,
yes,
I fucking put that together. And there's tons of other cogs and people that made it work, but I bloody grabbed that and created it as such.
I think the people I've got more respect for than anyone else, really, are writers, you see. Yeah. And I just think... All sorts of writers, you know, from novelists to playwrights to people that write articles now for the Daily Mash for Twitter, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just think writers are great, you know. I've written a few things myself, but not as much as I would like to, because it's hard. It is so hard. And it's, you know, it could be so... lonely and frustrating and whatever. So, you know, I just like, I always feel that I'm there as a director to serve the writer.
I was going
to
say, when working or when directing contemporary pieces, is there a lot of interaction with the writer and a lot of respect and back and forth in the process? Or is it very much you kind of take their work and make it your own, or make it...
Well, it's been
a
bit of both, actually, over the years.
Because it's generally, as soon as people were saying you need to talk about a theatre more, it highlighted how little I kind of know of the process of, like directing a film, you kind of know what happens there.
Yeah.
And directing a TV or whatever else, you kind of know that. There's a guy and there's cameras, there's this and that. It's like, there's not cameras in the theatre. So what is the process in the back and forth and in the turning it from something on paper to something... On stage?
Yeah, well, the process, I don't know. I mean, everyone's different. Everyone works in different ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, a lot of it is about preparation.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of pride myself on my casting. I've got it wrong. If anything's ever gone wrong with a production that I've directed, it is absolutely my fault.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
You know, the buck stops with me. If things go right, it's to do with the writer and the actors, right?
Yeah.
And that's not false modesty. That's the fucking truth of it, you know? And but I don't know. It's sort of, I just sort of throw myself in. People will be surprised, I think. You were talking earlier about lovely Stephen Graham, and he loves improvising.
Yeah.
I hate improvising.
Right.
I hate improvisation. I don't do any rehearsal where let's just improv around the script. I'm like, some writer has spent 2 years on his own writing some dialogue. Learn the fucking dialogue.
Learn it.
And if you can't get the grips with it, well, cut the lines.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to have you fucking improvising your ass off and showing off. Do you know what I mean? I'm not into that. You know,
amazing.
I find it a waste of time, really. I don't chuck beanbags around. I don't do trust games.
Yep.
You know, I'm not into that. It's all about just getting the right people together in the room, hopefully.
And getting the right script, I'd imagine.
Yeah,
getting
exactly.
If you've got that to start with, then the rest... I don't know, if you've got a script that excites you, not that the rest will be easy, but the work of the rest will be exciting because it's like, right, we're getting to bring this to life.
Yes.
And getting to put this all together.
If I could see it and feel it...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've had a bit of a dry period. You know, I haven't directed a play for 2 years now.
Yeah.
The last play I directed was at the Tricycle 2 years ago. And it's really because I haven't found a play that's, you know, made me go, oh, God, this is, I want to do this. You know, I would love to do this, you know.
This is, in a period like that, does it motivate you or make you start to think of writing something again, to kind of if you're not finding that play that you want to put on, is there any kind of urge to go, well, I'd best write the play that I want to put on, you know?
Yeah, it's funny though, not so much theatre. I mean, it's so strange. I have done a bit of writing, but I do, it's the only time I ever feel lonely, funny enough, is writing. I find it very difficult, you know? And you know, I've only ever written one play, which I wrote, like, in the last century. But I wrote a play because I wanted to direct a play.
Yeah.
And I only wanted to direct my own work back then because I was experimenting.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to fuck up someone else's work with me having
sense.
A little experiment,
yeah.
whether I can direct or not. So I wrote this play purely so that I could see if I could direct,
That's great. And then you also don't have the pressure of embarrassing yourself of not knowing something or how something works when working with a writer.
Yes.
Because it's like, well, I'm the writer. If there's anything I don't know, I'll figure it out and no one will know that I didn't know it.
Exactly.
as
no, that's
coming.
Beautiful.
It's like, we just get away with this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah. So that's what I did. Also, I did it because... Even though I wasn't in it, I wanted to sort of show that I had a brain in my head, that there was something else to me other than the parts I was getting as an actor. And I think I talked about this on Adam's podcast, and that sort of worked.
Yeah,
you know?
It touched on it. You were saying it made people kind of go, oh, right.
Yeah.
There's some stuff going on here. And even it was Ray Winston was in it. Right. And initially he was like, I'm not interested. And then...
Yeah, he wasn't interested because he wasn't interested in theatre.
Just read it.
Because there was no money in it. There's no money in it, you know. And that's another thing that people misunderstand, I think. You know, there is no money in theatre. There's sort of money in musicals, you know.
In one very specific area of theatre that's so marketable. And even more so now in musicals, if there's something that you can tag it onto, whether it be a band's back catalogue or a reworking of a film or anything else, or a musical film, it's even, I'd imagine, if there's a musical on at the Tricycle, there's not tons of money in it.
No.
It's only if it's this, in these grand situations.
And even then that's hard, you know, getting the money, and it's all a big risk, you know. So really, you don't do it for any other reason than the love, you know, or experience, you know, for a lot of people. A lot of people I know come out and they're doing acting and stuff and they're doing a lot of theatre work, but they're just desperate to get into TV and film, you know. And theatre is like the step up. That's where you learn your craft, you know.
From my point of view, it feels like the proper one as well, theatre, or the scarier, the pressure. I had Michael Socker on last week from This Is England, and from Aliens and Being Human, and he's about to do his first play in a long while since he was a kid. And he was saying how scary it is, because the fact is, when you're working in TV and film for so long, it becomes kind of a safety net, because you've got takes and retakes and retakes, and you've got so much space and time around a script and room to manoeuvre, that he was like, as soon as we stopped recording the podcast, all he was talking about was like, I'm petrified. I'm so scared, because the pressure's there to just get up there and do it.
Yeah.
Obviously, you prepare it, but the pressure there that it's not... Can we do that again? Just keep rolling. Let's do it again. Yeah. It's like, no, it just...
And also, you go into it. The problem with theatre is that if it's bad, it's really bad.
Right.
And it can put people off for life, you know?
Yeah. And the audience is right there. You can't say, like, with Once Upon a Time in the Midlands, I've never watched it. I wasn't quite into the experience at the time. I've never watched it. It's like, no, the crowd are there directly at that time.
Yeah.
So you have, you know what I mean? You're living that if it's not going well.
Absolutely. You know, it's so strange. I mean, I wish I didn't love it so much. Yeah. I wish I was happy. Just, you know, I'd have houses all over Europe if I'd stayed in bloody TV comedy.
Are you tempted to, or are you drawn to acting in theatre?
No.
Much? There's no appeal?
No. It's so strange. I think
it's interesting that it's so specific what has kind of grabbed you. And again, that's a good thing, to find the thing that that excites you and motivates you.
You know what I think a lot of it is to do with is my boredom threshold, you know. Mm-hmm. I get bored very, very quickly, you know. And even when I was younger, and I was acting and loved acting and loved doing theatre, there were a couple of times when things I was involved with then got transferred or had a longer life somewhere else, and I would always stop. I wouldn't go with it. And this was, you know, when I was skint and needed the money and whatever. And it was just because I know, because it's going to do my head in, and I'm going to just do it on automatic pilot.
Yeah.
And I never really liked that feeling, you know. And so the last time I did a play, I think I talked about this with Adam, was with Mike Lee. I did a Mike Lee play down in Stratford East.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mike Lee works in such a unique way.
Yeah.
I couldn't describe how he works, because it would take days, you know. Yeah. And it is unique to him. And it's sort of fascinating. It is so fascinating and interesting. And that as an actor, and particularly because it was theatre, like when I met him for the gig, he said, oh, I'm sorry this isn't a film, because everyone wants to do films. And I said, oh, no, I'm glad it's theatre, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Inside I was glad, because I thought, well, you ain't got total control.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And also, we will know before it goes on what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Because if you're in a Mike Lee film, you don't know what the film is until you go and see it. But anyway, I found the work process so brilliant.
Right.
So, what's the word? It was so stimulating.
Yeah.
And it was so exciting. And I loved being this character every night on stage.
Yeah.
That afterwards, everything just felt a bit flat, you know? It was just a bit, I don't know. You know, I was offered quite a few things and good parts and it was just a bit,
It must be hard to replicate that kind of excitement and buzz. And as you said, because I noticed, like, again, obviously you kind of, when preparing for these things, you'll go through IMDb and stuff like that and just a refresh and stuff. And it was noticeable that there was numerous things, particularly in TV, that you'd be in and have huge success from and then kind of walk away from. Because, again, it's that thing, I think, when something becomes popular, it's really hard to tell if you're still making it good. Because almost to an extent of, you could walk out on stage and fart and they're going to clap or crack up or be entertained because they're there for you and for that character or that thing. So,
yeah,
is that something true. That you kind of found would contribute to you losing interest in things? Is they'd get so big and it had almost become too easy with either with Perry or with Gimme 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 or things like that, where all people wanted to see was you come out and be that character. And I don't know, I guess that kind of, it makes it hard to know if the material's still going to be great and things like that. Which,
I mean, we stopped doing Gimme 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 because that was a mutual decision between myself and James and Jonathan, the writer. And it was really because it started to get dumbed down a little bit.
Right.
We wanted to get more outrageous. Once people realised what it was we were doing, we wanted it to go further, you know, and we wanted to break down the fourth wall more, do a lot more stuff down the lens, all stuff that they're very happy for people to do now, like Miranda and Mrs. Brown's Boys and all this business. But back then, the fashion, you know, it was the royal family had started, the office had started, so the fashion was, comedy now is sort of serious.
Yeah.
Comedy isn't screaming at each other and falling over and calling each other a puff and a slag. It's
serious and dramatic.
Absolutely, you know, and it's got to be classy and it's got to win BAFTAs and all this business. And I personally just thought, fuck that, you know.
I mean, that's what was great when you won for best comedy performance and kind of called people out on that and kind of said, like... But the thing that I loved about it was exactly that is... To hugely paraphrase, and again, essentially, I think, clean it up. It kind of said that the industry needs to stop just making for themselves.
Yeah.
And make... Because the fact is, they all turn their nose up at Gimme, 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 whatever, but the people sitting at home on a sofa, they fucking love it.
They love it.
And are actually enjoying it.
Know.
So, again, that felt like a real... It felt so personal and passionate that it's like, stop... And again, that is a weird thing in any industry, that it can start to be that these TV shows are being made so that other people in the industry will pat you on the back and stop thinking about what the actual public are enjoying or the public might like. And it becomes so self-referential that it can lose.
And the people were sort of scared of what it was we wanted to do, you know? So that's why we put a stop to that. It wasn't cancelled or it was no one else's decision other than ours, you know. And, you know, because it was getting more and more popular. But anyway, it was funny. Looking back on that, it's so strange because, I mean, I really loved working with Harry and Paul. Loved working with them. And I really
That got so huge at that point. It must have been an amazing thing to be part of.
Oh, it was. It was wonderful, you know, because it felt like everybody loved it, you know. And that was just at the end of there just being the five channels, you know, before the cable hit.
Yeah.
So it was sort of the last one of... It certainly felt that way. The last sort of sketch show that it seemed like the whole country was watching.
100%. It's a weird one to think back of. It was one of them shows that you didn't really hear some people saying, oh, I'm not really into it, or whatever else. It seemed everyone was like, yeah, into all the catchphrases, all the characters, and
yeah.
And it, again, it's another one that it grew and grew, and the and you were, I think, a real demonstration of that. Of the first series, I think you were only in the slobs,
yes,
as Waynetta Slob,
weren't
you?
Right.
In general, often is the case that if it's a sketch show, that first series will be the one you love, and then they'll have to add characters, and it won't really go over.
Yeah.
But then it was in the series on from that Kevin and Perry came in, and that was outshone everything, if anything. You know, it really did seem to kind of,
well, I think everybody got into Kevin and Perry because everyone's been a teenager, yeah, or their parents of teenagers, yeah, you know. So it was sort of, they were characters that everybody understood,
yeah,
you know.
I mean, we've talked a little bit about how restrictive roles can be for women in the industry.
Mm.
How amazing was it to get to play a teenage boy? Because that, again, that's not one of the typical female roles in the industry.
No,
that's
it's
not
only as really... Jeanette Cranky that, you know, made a career out of it.
Yeah.
She's still going, doing her little teenage boy.
Yeah, it gets weirder the longer it goes on.
I suppose, but,
yeah,
but hey, everyone's got to earn a living, you know. but, yeah, no, and I loved doing Perry. I really did.
Yeah.
I loved him. I just thought he was great. I'm not talking in terms of the reaction or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just saying he's a little human being.
Yeah.
He was so lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he was so nice to play because he was just a really nice boy.
Yeah.
Who'd obviously didn't have as nice a life as Kevin.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, Kevin had everything, and Kevin was from quite a respectable middle-class family, you know, and poor old Perry, you know, we don't really know where he came from, you know.
But we know he was always around Kevin's house than rather in his own house. And there's things that kind of, there's always those people in your life that there's some that are at home and have their friends over, and some that are always at someone else's house.
Yes.
So that kind of tells a lot. But, and it did come up on Adam's one, but I can't not, but again, his return from Manchester and all that, just all of that moment was just so perfect of its time, because he had been so quiet. And as you said, as such a nice, unbecoming kind of the sidekick, and then returning from Manchester was suddenly he's the grown up now, or he's the cool one, and had his swagger and his,
and it was so on the attitude. Money then, wasn't it? Because
spot
Oasis
on,
were like huge, you know.
Yeah.
God, it's so funny. It's all so long ago. Like when I think about it now, it's like, God, crumbs. You know, God, I wish I'd enjoyed it more, you know.
I
never, you know, you get invited to all these things, and I just never, I was so strange. Like, even the recordings, like recording Harry Enfield and recording Gimme Gimme, you know, I wouldn't have any mates there.
Yeah.
I didn't invite people.
You're at work, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Work,
it was work, you know. And it was just so odd looking back, because I wouldn't hang around for drinks afterwards or, you know, and I remember sort of getting the car back and going over the Westway and sort of looking out the window. I remember thinking, what am I doing? I'm going home. You know,
it's fascinating.
It's so strange.
Because it's such a weird balance, because I think in many ways that's key, or that will have been a key influence in keeping you very grounded in it all, because you're not getting caught up in all that afterwards, everyone telling you how wonderful it is. Or, I don't know, you're kind of there for the creation of the art and not there for the appraisal of the art, if you know what I mean. So, but equally, as said, it kind of meant that maybe at the time you missed out on what a big thing it was, or what a big experience it was, I guess.
Yeah. But it'd be so, I mean, God, if social media was around then, can you imagine?
Yeah.
It would be so different, you know.
100%.
I'd probably have like 2 million followers and I'd probably be ignoring them all.
Yeah, exactly.
Not retweeting anyone that didn't have a blue tick, you know.
100%.
But, yeah, I don't know. I'm such a strange sort of person in a way, in that I'm so unsuited to this business in a way. But I love it. I really love it. And I sort of love it more now I'm older, really. Because I like all the youngsters that are coming up, you know. I mean, over the years, I've also, I didn't know it at the time that I was a mentor for a lot of people. Yeah. But I was.
Yeah.
You know, looking back, it just felt like I was giving people advice and helping people out and what have you. Yeah. But looking back, it was like, oh, no, actually, I sort of did help quite a lot of people.
That's great.
Have their breaks and what have you, you know, which is great. And I sort of feel I'm more proud of all that, you know, really.
And it must be nice because when you're in the middle of it and you're winning awards and there's a lot of hype and talk, it must be nice later on because it's not all about, oh, you're about to become this or you're about to become that. You kind of know who you are now or know what you are and where you are rather than, well, it's Hollywood next or it's this next or whatever else next. All that kind of instant pressure of, well, and particularly, I mean, A Nil by Mouth was, as we've touched upon, was a massive film in every way, in the performances to the reaction to everything else. And there was a very much, obviously, you had people like Gary Oldman, obviously writing and directing and everything, and Ray and all these who were then like, oh, well, now they're going to go off and do this or go off and do that. So there is that weird pressure of you've done this, now you're meant to be aiming for this.
And well,
talking to you, it's not, that's it. You're not necessarily excited by that or motivated by that. So it must be nicer now to kind of go, I don't have to worry about what I'm meant to be doing or what they're expecting me to do or anything like that.
I mean, my regret about it all, I suppose, if I've got any regret, it's the fact that when you get to do all that schmoozing and you're invited to here, there and everywhere, your mates can be part of it as well, you see. Yeah. And so, you know, my mates sort of missed out a lot on, you know, it's like, oh my God, you know, you could get free tickets to this concert and that, you know. But I get very embarrassed.
It's a wonderful regret to have of the guilt of, I forgot to sort my mates out. Shit, I mean, I chose not to be there. That sounds like a nightmare, but I didn't think about that they could be there as well.
Well, whenever we did go to do's anyway, I'd always end up getting the hump. I just would get the hump. I'd get into a rage and I couldn't bear it.
I'm way better at all of that, at schmoozing and all that on social media than in real life. Yeah. I'm far more comfortable sitting in my living room chatting to someone and interacting and engaging than feeling the pressure of being at some party where everyone's in the know. Do you know what I mean? And there's that weird expectation on who you're going to be or what you're going to be.
Well, it's interesting in terms of, like, theatre because, you know, really what I should be doing now, which could have been and was there as an opportunity for me, particularly, you know, 10 years ago, when I gave up the acting and was focusing on directing, what I really should have done was run a building, you know, become the artistic director of somewhere.
Yeah.
Because then you have the freedom, really, of, not freedom so much, but you've got more opportunity to direct constantly. You know, with me, there are big gaps between me directing.
Yeah.
And the reason why I never wanted to run a building was because that's not all it entails, you know. You have to have social skills.
Yeah.
You have to talk to people that are investing in the building.
You need to do that side of the industry and win people over.
You have to, absolutely, you know. It's sort of more, it's the main thing you have to do.
Whereas directing, you're entering into this place on a temporary basis, doing the artistic part that you've signed up for, and then you get to leave
and
move on to the next place to swoop in and out and not have to worry about any of that side of it.
Exactly.
Anyone you should be
and dealing with
up.
The money and talking to accountants and you know, doing the schmoozing, you know, you've got to, you know, have nights with the mayor and you've got to, you know, and I'm just not made that way, really. I can't. I'll always offend somebody.
Yeah.
I don't mean to, you know. There's this saying where people, I saw some bloke say it. I'd never heard it before. I saw somebody say it on first dates that they've got no filter. That's probably an old saying. But I'd never heard that before, and I thought, when they said it, I thought, I think I'm a bit like that.
Yeah.
I think maybe that's been my problem. You know, it's probably been a good thing, but it's also been to my detriment, you know.
100%.
So...
I feel it's almost a catchphrase of mine to say to some of my close friends is, look, you know that if you're discussing something with me, you're always going to get the brutal truth. So, you know, as a precursor for it, I'm about to not have a filter and say, I think you're being a dick, or I think you're, you know, I think this is right, or this
but
is
I
right.
I expect the same back. 100%. Do you expect the same
completely,
back?
Completely.
I don't like it if somebody hasn't sort of, if somebody's, a lot of the time, I suppose they want to protect you, like they'll hide the truth. What they really think.
That's what's interesting in this industry as well. And I had Ed Skrein on the other day, who was in Ill Manners and is in Dead Porn. He's doing great things. And he was saying, I can't remember if it was in the podcast or when we were chatting beforehand, but he had to really explain to his agents. He's like, if something's shit, tell me it's shit. If I'm sending you a tape, don't dance around. Just let me know. Because it is kind of... seemingly an alien thing in this industry that in general people will tiptoe around and be careful of people's feelings, which, as I'm saying out loud, that sounds like a lovely thing that people are careful of. That's nice, but again, it's not, and I completely agreed with Ed on that and connected with that on, like, well, no, if just tell me the truth. Just tell me the truth.
Because in any
working,
other job, if you're a shit postman, you'll get told you're a shit postman.
You're
not walking, you're taking hours.
Yeah.
You get the sack.
Yeah.
You're not told... oh, well,
it's different.
Your delivery was great today, you know.
Didn't quite, the direction was different.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, no.
Yeah, but you have to take
was it shit?
As well as giving it out, you know. And that's why I sort of, you know, I don't mind. If people are honest with me, I really don't mind. But I will tell other people about other people's honesty.
Yeah.
Somebody has said, I think you're shit, I'll tell everyone else.
No, they think I'm shit.
Yeah.
You know Mark, he thinks I'm shit. I thought he was a nice thing.
Yeah.
I'll start to wrap things up because we're over the hour, Mark. But there's a few more things and you've got a dinner party.
Oh, so you're
tall.
Yeah. What you could do before you leave as well is put that clock forward an
hour. I'll sort your clock out, not a problem at all.
Is it forward or back?
Yeah, it's forward. It would have gone... forward the last one, of course.
I've not had anyone tall here, you see, so you can...
I'll pop that, easy.
Yeah.
I've got my uses. You spoke about, imagine if social media had been around in... when you're doing Harry Enfield and Gimme, Gimme, Gimme. Another one that springs to mind, again, we keep touch upon it, and again, I don't want to go into tons of detail because there's some amazing stories in Adam's podcast about Sid and Nancy and about Anil by Mouth and your relationship with Gary Oldman and
what did I say?
You said some great stuff.
I didn't know that I love him and respect him.
No, that was it. It was beautiful because there was a love and respect, but also he was a dickhead at that point and he was a nightmare
but
at this point.
But it's something he would admit himself.
Yeah, completely. But what it occurred to me was that was a film. I had an actress called Georgina Campbell on a little while ago who did. Murdered by My Boyfriend.
Oh, she's great.
Which was amazing. But that came out at the time of social media, so she saw a huge response from people who'd been through similar stuff.
Yes.
And it made me think of Neil by Mouth, because I'd imagine you still would have somehow heard from a lot of people who had experienced similar things, but the fact is you were taking on a huge topic and pulled it off beautifully. It makes me think if social media had been about then, it would have been an interesting one just because you would have had a lot of, or had to decide how to handle a lot of people coming forward with their issues or people have been through similar things. But did you experience a lot of that at the time, I guess, is what I'm trying to stumble around, of people who related hugely to that role and that
performance.
Yeah,
absolutely. But back then you'd get letters.
Yeah,
of course, you'd get letters or just people talking to you about it if you were at the pub, because I did go to pubs back then.
Yeah, yeah.
And, or cab drivers, because I didn't go on the tube.
So
I'd get a lot of black cabs, you know, and get a lot of cab drivers saying, that was my mum's story, that's my sister's story, you know. And I remember, you know, coming to its defence a lot because there were, you know, the privileged classes were sort of feeling it was a very over-the-top film, right. And this sort of stuff didn't go on.
Right, yeah.
So that was infuriating because you wanted to defend it. But your only form of defence was doing fucking interviews with people who, you know, would then, you know, not them in particular, but their editors would then edit the whole interview in the way they wanted it to come across anyway.
Yeah.
So you never really felt, God, I just can't express what I'm feeling.
It's tough because if their issue was with the harshness of it, then that's the same thing that's going to make them edit out certain parts of an interview that's talking about the realness of it and how it is real, it's not.
And actually, there was a lot more violence in the original script, and Gary cut a lot of it out. Yeah. He toned a lot of it down.
And it's I always remember when Irreversible came out by Gaspar Noé, and in that he got a lot of stick because there was a very brutal and very long rape scene, but it was all just one shot, and a lot of people walked out of the cinema and were disgusted, and he summed it up perfectly in his press interviews. He said, well, you should feel uncomfortable and unpleasant. It's a horrific thing.
Yeah.
And the fact is, in so many films, you'll sit there comfortably eating popcorn as something horrible's going on, and then you'll feel nothing at the end. He said, I'm glad that people are disgusted and shocked at this, because it's a horrific thing, and it's similar with Kneel by Mouth. It is an uncomfortable watch.
Yeah.
But it should be. Yeah. Because these aren't things that you should be able to just go, right, I wonder what's going to happen next. It should be feeling horrific and moved and emotional about it, right?
Absolutely. I totally agree. And I'm so proud to be part of that film.
Yeah.
And also it's because, you know, I grew up watching people like Ken Loach and Alan Clark and, you know, and it felt like, oh, I'm finally in something like the things I used to watch and that I found inspirational and that made me understand about the world a lot of the time. And it was The Play for Today's and reading novels. It you know, I that was where I got all my education from, you know, about human beings, you know. So, yeah, no, I'm extremely, extremely proud of it. But again, it was a bit like, oh, flipping heck. Everything else after that felt flat. Again, it just felt
you've had that experience. Flat. Such a,
it was like, you know.
How was the experience of filming it? Because, again, you're doing a heavy story and some heavy issues. Were you, or was it comfortable switching off at night when I've done some stuff on and with, and my mum's a Samaritan. Mm. And one of the things I found fascinating was learning that at the end of a Samaritan shift, they have to call someone who's one of the Samaritans who are at home and just offload.
Okay.
And the act of just going through what's happened. And it kind of explained to me how Samaritans do that, of hearing potentially horrific things and then just go home and go on with their lives. And they had this process of offloading. Did you feel you needed to offload anything on these, or was it very much a cut? All right, well, it's acting.
Yeah.
It's not real, you know.
Yeah, the latter for me.
Yeah.
It did feel it was acting and it wasn't real. And I've said this before, I used to, and I never went out drinking with the guys. You know, Jamie and Ray and you know, they'd go out, you know, Gary didn't drink. He stopped the drink long before. I think really the whole thing was harder for Gary than anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, this was his writing and his directing. This was his story.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it was difficult for anyone, it was difficult for him.
I kind of get that from what you were saying about the control of directing, is the kind of the way as an actor in the scene, you can kind of be like, well, he's making this happen. It's, do you know what I mean? If we're pushing it harsher and harder, it's on the director's head rather than on my head.
I mean, you know? I was fine. Listen, I you know, I felt so safe, you know. I had to be on the end of quite a bit of brutality.
Yeah.
Verbal as well as physical.
Yeah.
Everyone remembers the physical abuse, but there's lots of verbal abuse that this character has to put up with.
Yeah.
But I've never felt so safe. I've never felt so protected, A, by the director, and also by my fellow actors, yeah. You know? It's one of the toughest and most brutal stories I've ever been a part of yeah. in its telling. But I would go home every night, and I had a little flat then, a little council flat, and I loved my little flat.
Yeah.
And I loved the fact I weren't with some horrible bastard
yeah.
that was trying to control me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I should say horrible, fucked up bastard
yeah.
because Ray's character
yeah.
is a victim of abuse himself.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
And, but I loved it. I loved going into work every day. It was exciting. I'd never, you know, sort of been involved in a story where the dialogue was so wonderful. I've never found a script so easy to memorise, because that's a trick as well. If people find it difficult to learn lines, a lot of the time it's because the lines
that's fascinating,
aren't necessary.
That, yeah.
They're not meant to be there,
yeah.
you know. If the dialogue flows and is real, you learn it. You learn it so quickly. I'm not the only actor that has said this. You
yeah,
know, you ask
yeah.
any actor, they'll always say the better the script, the easier it is
yeah.
to learn, you
yeah,
know?
That's great.
And I just sort of loved it. And, you know, these are really intelligent people that I was working with,
yeah.
really smart, intelligent, highly intelligent and hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really weird because you talk about, well, yeah, this was a really harsh hitting film and it was a very important subject matter.
Yeah.
But I laughed every day, you know.
Yeah. And again, I'd imagine that's essential. It's the kind of the gallows humour type
yeah.
thing of people saying with in A&E, there's so
yes.
much joke and mockery going on and it's not disrespectful. It's to keep you together in these intense situations.
Absolutely, which is why I like Twitter, because,
yeah.
you know, the shit happens in the world and there'll always be someone, whether it's too much or,
yeah.
you know, whatever, there'll always be someone
there's a comedian,
that's got a joke about it, you know?
There's a comedian called Anthony Jeselnik who is amazing. And, again, he thrives on those situations. And in his last stand-up, he kind of said, people get offended or when he makes a joke about a recent tragedy. But he said, the fact is, no one involved in a recent tragedy is on Twitter the next day.
No.
So it's not that... he's like, it's kind of saying, I'd never want to offend them. The fact is, the people who are getting offended are the people who are sitting there going... And he puts it as don't forget about me. Kind of
yeah.
saying, I'm so sad to see what happened in XYZ. It's like,
yeah.
it's kind of just waving your hand to say, remember, there's a tragedy, but I'm sad about it. So
yeah.
don't forget that. And it's kind of, that's his...
And I think that's fair enough.
Yeah.
I like the fact, if you want to have a voice, you've got a voice now,
100%.
You know?
Yeah.
I remember, I'll do a name drop now, just to finish. So a couple of years ago, this is before I was on Twitter or whatever, so Benedict Cumberbatch
yeah.
gets in touch with me, right? And I don't know what he said. He said something in the press about being stereotyped or I don't know what he said,
yeah.
right? And he phoned me up and he said, my press agent said I should talk to you about it, about what do I do about this? How do I respond? Because 20 years ago, I'd had a bit of a public spat with Helena Bonham Carter,
right?
You see, and it wasn't a public spat in that way. It was sort of, she said something in an interview and I responded to it in a letter.
Right.
And so it was a big thing about class and actors and everyone's fucking, no one gives a shit, really. No one gives a shit. But he said to me, you know, it was something like, you know, why, you know, but why did you do that? And, you know, because he really wanted to speak out and defend himself.
Yeah.
Which I think is right.
Yeah.
But I said to him, but you've got to be prepared, Benedict, for the backlash, you know? And he said, yeah, but why did you speak out back then, and this is before I did Kneel by Mouth, yeah. This is before, you know, I was just sort of making rumblings.
Yeah.
Some people, I had a sort of cult thing about me, you know. And I said to Benedict, the reason why I wrote that letter back then was because Helena was the only actress who had a voice. They were only interviewing Helena.
Yeah.
You know, and I like Helena Bonham Carter. Yeah. I've got a lot of time for the woman, you know. But back then, it was like she was speaking on behalf of all of us.
Yeah.
So if she said something that I considered stupid, well, what could I do about it? No one's listening to me. It's no one was fucking interviewing me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, so I decided, I'm going to write a letter about this interview she's done, you know. And I said to Benedict, it's different now because we've all got a voice now if we want it, you know.
Yeah.
And back then we didn't, you know. Why have we said that now? Is that going back to Twitter, was it?
Yeah, I'm lost now as well. But no, completely it is that. It's having that voice and having that right to reply, I guess, is exciting. Oh, no, we were talking about when the tragedy happens or something like that, if people can express sadness or they can express humour or they can express anything they want.
And I think, even though it might get on me personally, it might get on me nerves.
Yeah.
When someone's like, I think this is out of order. I've had that directed at me because I've made some very crass jokes on there.
Yeah, yeah.
And not when I'm drunk, when I'm stoned.
Yeah.
And people have tweeted me and gone, I'm very disappointed in you, Kathy. I expected better of you. I'm sort of thinking, yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, you know what I mean?
I know you've never met. Why did you expect that?
But I accept it.
Yeah.
I sort of think, well, you're just as entitled to have a voice as I am.
100%, yeah.
And my voice is only louder because I've fucked about on the television for 20-odd years, you know? But let the people speak.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I mean, let's wrap things up with just what's kind of ahead, because you've been lured back into acting in recent years with the amazing a Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and numerous other little projects coming in. Are you looking to, are you keen to return in that realm, or are you still just looking for the right script to direct? Or?
Yeah, I'm mainly looking for the right script to direct. I mean, there was a young lady here just before you arrived called Emily, who's a new up and coming theatre producer.
Yeah.
I really like what this young woman is doing, and so she has seen a lot of my past directing work, and she would love to produce something that I can direct.
Yeah.
But we just haven't found the right one script. Yet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And going back to the writing, just, you know, I did a bit of writing a couple of years ago, and I was commissioned to write something, and I did for television, but it wasn't taken up. It wasn't. Right. They didn't want to do it. So that was a bit of a kick in the teeth, actually.
Right.
And so that, I think, has knocked my confidence a little bit on the writing front. I mean, I am meant to be working on a project at the moment for the National Theatre, which was an idea I went to them with.
Yeah.
And I was going great guns with it, and then I just came to sort of full stop. I hit a brick wall. And suddenly I was, my confidence has gone a bit on it, really. I'm saying this out loud to you because I haven't got in touch with them.
No,
and
that's
let
great.
Them know
and
this
let them know.
Yet.
Do you have anyone you bounce things off of or work with on these things? Or do you find it, as you said before, you find writing as quite a lonely endeavour. Is there anyone you bounce things off of, or would you work with someone else in a writing project or partnership?
I've tried to sort of sit down with other people. It never quite happens. I don't know why. It's weird. No, I've never found that easy, actually. Not easy. That's the wrong word. It's not that I want it to be easy. I've sort of found that,
but never clicked with it in that way.
Yeah. There's a great woman, but she works in television. There's a great woman called Pippa Brown. When I wrote my TV piece, I did this autobiographical thing, and Pippa worked on that with me, but not the writing.
Right.
I would email it to her, you know, as it was going on, you know.
Right.
And then on that project, actually, the brilliant Jeremy Dyson, yeah. League of Gentlemen guy,
yeah, yeah.
Psycho Bitches and all the rest of it, and Ghost Stories, he came on board for this thing I wrote, Walking and Talking, and
yeah.
It was lovely. He was absolutely brilliant, but he didn't do any writing with me. Well,
yeah.
Well, what he did basically was tell my producer, Ben Cavey, leave it alone. Don't yeah, touch yeah. it. You know, let it just be as it is, you know.
It's perfect finding those people at the right...
Oh, yeah.
Point, no, to give you that confidence as well, even if it is just someone saying, no, everyone leave this alone because it's great. It, do you know what I mean? It gives you that confidence
it
to go,
does.
This is right. It's not just me thinking it's right. It's
yeah.
fucking right.
Yeah. But it was weird with the last piece because of that getting rejected, you see.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm just not used to rejection, mm-hmm. you know? It might be that, you
yeah.
know? Because I think, actually, it's the first thing I've ever done that has been rejected.
Right. Yeah.
And it, I do think it was sort of, it was sort of part of the depression as well last
yeah.
year, you know. It just sort of added to it and just sort of feeling, you know, I just sort of felt, well, you know, maybe I've done it. Maybe it's all gone. I don't know. Maybe there isn't.
I think
there's
always a constant feeling in anything creative that you're going to get found out any minute now.
Yeah.
So again, I guess if you get a knockback in some way, it might be despite the fact that you've got tens of years of proof that you know what you're doing,
yeah.
you're good at this. That one time that comes, it's kind of as we said earlier about how on Twitter you'll get 10 tweets of praise and one calling you a cunt, and,
yeah.
and that's the one that you'll notice. So again, it's that interesting thing. It's yeah, I'm not going to try and give advice and therapy here of, you know, but it's focusing on we've just spoken for 90 minutes almost
yeah.
on about a third of the work that you've done over the years, yet it's that one bit that that gets rejected or whatever that will instantly grate in
and just
knock
niggles.
Your confidence.
Yeah, 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 just
weird.
Niggles.
Humans are weird.
Yeah,
the brain's an odd space.
I know. Why can't we just be happy? I mean, I am quite a happy person.
Yeah.
I mean, I say I'm grumpy and
yeah.
I'm depressed and I'm all that, but I'm also a happy person.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're all like that. We're all multi-layered.
And that's completely all right. It's one of the things I rant about the most, and it gets kind of a misunderstood because I've kind of said before that I think at points happiness is slightly overrated.
Yeah.
Or we put too much pressure on it. If you're not instantly happy constantly, then people are like, are you all right? What's wrong? It's like sometimes you don't have to be bubbling constantly.
Yeah.
You have a range of emotions.
Yeah.
Sometimes something shit will happen and you'll feel shit. That's right. That's because something shit's happened. That's natural.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that weird thing of if you're not constantly bubbly, then you're miserable or you're a misery. But
yeah.
It's fine to have that.
I mean, especially when
right?
you're younger. I so like being in my 50s, mate. I tell
yeah.
you. I think it's much tougher, like, when you're young, in your 20s and your
yeah.
30s, and, oh...
Pressure to be a certain way.
Oh, absolutely. And it's like, you know, just be content, just, you know, brush your teeth. Always make sure your teeth are clean, your breath don't stink, and try not to be a cunt. Now, that's the first time I've said it, I think.
It is, and that's also the perfect point to end the podcast on, because that's the best advice, that's life advice to take away.
Yeah.
I've got to sort your clock out, so we'll
yeah.
wrap it up there. And
great.
Thank you very much for allowing me in to chat. It's been lovely.
Been a darling. Thanks for putting up with all my smoke.
It's fine. Thank you.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks. Discretion,
please. There we go. What a lovely lady. And she did tone down the swearing. I tried to encourage more of it, but she was quite reserved with it all. So good work, Kathy. And yeah, I really enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed it too. Now, let me tell you about the next 2 weeks, because there's two episodes coming up that I'm really excited about. One, I think you'll all be familiar with, and one will be a bit of a surprise. So next week, I've got Izzy
Sooty on, who's fantastic, obviously from Peep Show and a million other things. Hilarious, warm and engaging. And it was another one. I seem to be saying this a lot. I said this with Michael Socker last week, with Kathy this week. It was another one where we'd never really met. I think our paths had kind of crossed half. I'd seen her at shows and things like that. And it was just the easiest conversation. And we sat down and just chatted and the time flew by. So yeah, I really enjoyed that one. But the other one I want to tell you about is in 2 weeks' time. And it's with a wrestler called Will Ospreay. And you may or may not have heard of him, but that's why this is exciting. The thing that excites me about the Distraction Pieces podcast is I try to get people on who, regardless of if you've heard of them, it's going to be interesting and engaging. And the interesting thing with Will, Will's 23 and he's a British wrestler. He's wrestled for Progress and Rev Pro and numerous great companies and built a real name for himself. And he recently got signed by New Japan Pro Wrestling, which is one of the biggest wrestling organizations in the world. And he's wrestling out there in Japan. But he's also a 23-year-old who's maintaining his day job, working on building sites. And it's an amazing story, man. We get to hear about how a few weekends ago, He made his New Japan debut to a huge, huge reaction, part of a huge team, part of a huge stable. Wrestled in front of 11,000 people and tore the house down. And a few days later, he's back on a building site in Essex, laying down mastic and doing his work. And yeah, it's a fascinating tale. I won't go into too much detail, but he started wrestling at 14. And it's one of those weird ones where he had what some might see as an unrealistic dream and his parents went, all right, cool. All right, let's run with this. Let's support and see where you can get. And he's now one of the most hyped wrestlers in the world. Like, genuinely, at 23, he's at New Japan now. There's obviously interest and excitement in America. And I genuinely can see him becoming the best in the business in his career. So yeah, it was exciting to get to talk to him, and he's a local Essex lad, so that's even more exciting. But yeah, I think you'll enjoy that one regardless of your interest in wrestling. I posted about the wrestling podcast, and whilst there's been huge support of Tuesday Night Jaw, a few people were like, oh, I'm not into wrestling. It's like, that's absolutely fine. And on that podcast, I'd say if you're not into wrestling, probably ain't for you, because we nerd out quite a bit. But this one, if you're not into wrestling, it really doesn't matter, because it's a hell of a story. Anyway, I'm going to go, and I'll be back next week with Izzy Sooty. Is there anything else I need to tell you? I don't think so. Oh, the Distraction Pieces live show. The tickets are flying out. Thank you so much. You can buy them now. It's on August 3rd, on my birthday, at the Leicester Square Theatre. You can buy tickets now. It's my birthday and book launch celebration, so I will be turning 35 and I will be having the Distraction Pieces book out, and I'll be able to sign any and sell them and all this. It's going to be a beautiful thing, so come along to that. Right, I'll see you guys in a bit. Cheers, bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.